Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. There are new demands from the Islamic State. The Japanese government is investigating a video that appears to show the militants have killed one of two Japanese hostages. In the video, one of the Japanese men, journalist Kenji Goto, is holding up photos of the other hostage, Haruna Yukawa, in which he appears to have been beheaded. In the video, a man's voice purporting to be Goto is heard in English with Arabic subtitles. He says the militants now no longer want money and instead are demanding the release of Sajiwa Al-Rishawi, a female attempted suicide bomber imprisoned in Jordan. The Islamic State group threatened Tuesday to behead the hostages within 72 hours unless it received a ransom. Thousands of Yemenis marched in protest today against Shiite rebel Houthis in power after the resignation of the president and the government earlier this week. Henry Ridgewell reports from Sana'a.
The well-armed rebels patrolling the streets say they are not seeking conflict. Murad Mohammed is one of them. He says the Houthis are here to serve the Yemeni people and provide security and safety to serve all the people. The president's resignation, however, has left a dangerous power vacuum, says Yemen specialist Kate Nevins of the conflict prevention group Safer World.
The Houthis are actually unlikely to want full administrative power themselves. I think they are unlikely to want to be held accountable as a formal government.
The Houthis make up around a third of the Yemeni population. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is headed to Nigeria, there to meet with the country's two leading presidential candidates and urge that next month's elections be free and fair. The elections are complicated by the rise of the militant group Boko Haram, which has killed thousands in the northeast and controls Borno State. This is VOA News. Ukrainian authorities say at least 21 people are dead, more than 80 others wounded after rockets hit a market in the key port city of Mariupol. The attack on the residential area came hours after the rebel leader in the Donetsk region said there will be no further peace talks with Kiev. On Friday, Russian-backed Alexander Zakharchenko, the self-declared head of the Donetsk People's Republic, said his forces will attack government troops until reaching the borders of the Donetsk region. He claimed to be advancing against combat troops from Ukraine after seizing control of the long-contested airport on Thursday. President Barack Obama heads to India today to hold talks with Prime Minister Narendra Modi on climate change and economic ties. Mr. Obama is the first U.S. president to attend India's Republic Day ceremony, which he will do on Monday, marking the day India's constitution took effect in 1950. C. Raja Mohan is with an Indian-based think tank.
This is not often that the president of the United States comes to India to be part of the Republic Day celebrations.
The two leaders established rapport when Mr. Modi visited Washington, D.C. last year, and the president and first lady are invited as Mr. Modi's guests for the ceremonies. U.S. and Cuban officials are reporting progress from initial talks in Havana on reestablishing diplomatic ties. VOA's Pam Dawkins reports.
The talks laid the groundwork for a U.S. plan to remove sanctions and a more than 50-year-old trade embargo against Cuba. The road ahead will be long and complex, says Assistant Secretary of State Roberta Jacobson. She said the U.S. and Cuba seek to advance shared interests.
This will include building on incipient dialogues in the areas of global health security, counter-narcotics, law enforcement, environmental cooperation, education exchanges, and combating trafficking in persons.
But she added there are continuing areas of disagreement over issues including the status of fugitives and freedom of expression. And also, Cuban officials say they disagree with the U.S. designation of their country as a state sponsor of terrorism. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
World leaders are descending on Saudi Arabia to pay respects following the death of King Abdullah. Despite deep tensions between the nations, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, was one of the first to arrive today. President Barack Obama is cutting short a visit to India to fly to the Sunni-ruled kingdom on Tuesday. Vice President Joe Biden was to have led a delegation on the president's behalf, but will now remain behind in Washington. Others arriving to offer condolences and meet the new king include Britain's Prince Charles and Prime Minister David Cameron, French President Francois Hollande, Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was among the Muslim leaders who attended King Abdullah's funeral on Friday in the capital of Riyadh. The 90-year-old king passed on. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clawty in Washington.
We have evidence that this election has been rigged. There are gross irregularities which the Electoral Commission of Zambia itself is aware of.
Zambia opposition party demands re-verification of election results after citing proof of vote rigging.
There's a long history in the case of the Southern Kaduna, a long history of perceived injustices, perceived political domination from the northern part against the southern part of the city.
Some Nigerians express concern about possible religious violence in parts of the country ahead of the February 14 general election.
It is not 60 days yet, nor is it 90 days yet. But we are ready to keep watching the clock and the calendar.
And lawyers vow to challenge the Ugandan government if it refuses to approve the retirement request of renegade Army General David Sejusa. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, or UPND, has called on the Electoral Commission of Zambia, ECZ, to verify all the results of the presidential by-election, citing evidence of voter irregularities, it said, undermines the credibility of the vote. Canisius Banda, deputy president of the UPND in charge of politics, told me earlier today that the verification has to be done in the presence of all the political parties, stakeholders, and the independent election poll monitoring groups to ensure the winner represents the will of the people.
We have evidence that this election has been rigged. There are gross irregularities which the Electoral Commission of Zambia itself is aware of and has admitted that a number of results have been adulterated by people they don't know, but we know the people, some of them, are workers within the Electoral Commission of Zambia. The evidence of rigging of malpractice is there and it is overwhelming. And we have engaged the Electoral Commission of Zambia that for the sake of the growth and maturity of democracy, for the sake of national unity and peace, we must verify thoroughly all the results. This must be done before any winner is declared. And our emphasis is on that, so that the declaration is based on the truth and nothing but the truth. We have evidence that there has been malpractice.
But, Dr. Canisius Banda, if you are not pleased, if the UPND is not pleased with the conduct or the irregularities that you said you have evidence to prove your case, why wouldn't you launch it at the Supreme Court and challenge it legally?
No. The evidence is already there. The evidence is already there, sir. And we do not want the winner to be declared before after the verification has been done. We want the verification to be done first. The winner must only be declared after the verification. We do not want to go to court after the declaration. That would be a waste of time. We want the declaration to be based on truth. The ECZ has evidence. We have evidence. We don't need weeks to have evidence. We already have it. So all we are calling for is that let us be patient, even if it takes a week. Let us verify together with all other political parties and all these question marks that the ECZ has, we have, other political parties have, let them be removed before the declaration is made. That's our call. The evidence is already there of malpractice, irregularities, figure switching, adjustment to digits and things like that. We already have the evidence. Let us verify. Let the verification be done in the presence of independent observers. We don't mind that. We just want the truth to prevail. We want democracy to mature. We want national unity and peace to continue here.
Dr. Banda, you're talking about verification. You are going to meet officials of the Electoral Commission. Are you going to raise this, and do you expect them to act on this call for all the results to be thoroughly verified?
Yes, Peter, we have already engaged them, and they have agreed that many of the results have been adulterated, and they agree that we must verify. Now, we want this process of verification itself to be thorough and transparent and inclusive. Let any stakeholder participate. Let us verify. Let the citizens know the truth. Let the winner be the accurate reflection of their choice. That's all we want. We are not saying we have won. Oh, God, yes, our figures show that. But we are not saying that. We are saying let us verify. And if we haven't won after verification, we shall be at peace with that. But let us get rid of these question marks. And the ECZ itself is aware. They have evidence of irregularities, of rigging. So let's verify, let the truth prevail, and democracy will grow and mature in this country. And national unity, which is fundamental, national peace, which is fundamental, will prevail.
What has been the response of the Electoral Commission of Zambia since you called for these results to be thoroughly verified?
The Electoral Commission of Zambia should be commended. The Electoral Commission of Zambia should be commended. It's an institution that must be strengthened. Collectively, as citizens, we own it. We established it. We value elections. We value democracy. So this is an institution that the UPND, given a chance, would make independent. So they're agreeable that we must verify. So verify we should. Let us verify in the presence of all other political parties, including the ruling party. Let us verify and let there be independent monitors. And that way, the truth will prevail and national unity and peace shall be maintained.
Canisius Banda is the deputy president of Zambia's opposition UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. For the latest update on Zambia's election, Richard Mulunga, a freelance journalist, joins us live via telephone link up from the capital, Lusaka. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Peter.
How are you doing?
We're fine here, Peter. We're here.
Now tell me this. As you've heard this controversy surrounding the election results being released by the Electoral Commission, what is the latest update on this controversy?
Generally, here in Zambia and in the capital, Lusaka, it's quiet and peaceful. People are waiting for the latest and last update from the Electoral Commission of Zambia, when the ultimate winner will be announced. But word is already out there that the ruling party candidate, Edgar Lungu, has scooped the presidency with a very narrow margin. And everyone seems to have accepted, apart from the UPND, that have raised a number of issues, as have been outlined by Dr. Canisius Banda, the deputy president of the opposition UPND.
Now, whoever wins, in this case, Edgar Lungu, who is tipped to win, could win by a simple majority. And that, I believe, is the concern of the UPND, Hakainde Hichilema, and of course, his deputy, Dr. Canisius Banda. How is the Electoral Commission reacting to concerns of voter irregularities or rigging, as Dr. Banda said?
Yes, the Electoral Commission of Zambia here has acknowledged that there have been some errors in the figures. Some constituencies were some constituencies here were receiving figures that were representing other constituencies. So there are a number of errors that have been noted, and the ECZ chairperson, Justice Irene Mambilim, has acknowledged that. But over and above, the commission has insisted that it is a professional organization, it is independent of the state, and it is conducting a credible election. Therefore, it takes a great exception at the accusations of rigging and all these irregularities. Actually, the ECZ the chairperson is about to go live on air here to give an update and address all these concerns that have been raised.
But you know, the concerns, don't you think that the concerns would have to be addressed before the winner is declared? That is the stance of the UPND. Of course, supporters of the Patriotic Front, Edgar Lungu, rejoicing, you know, with the expectation that they could win the presidency again. Now, will the Electoral Commission satisfy these concerns of the UPND before announcing the winner of the election? Have they given any indication about that?
You see, the problem that we have in Zambia here is that we have a weak constitution, and no wonder the civil society, political parties, and everyone else have been advocating for a strong constitution that would address some of these things that you have outlined, Peter, here. Because the law here in Zambia does not stop the Electoral Commission from declaring or inaugurating a candidate who has won by a simple majority. Because in any case, if the Electoral Commission of Zambia begins to delay the inauguration of the presidential candidate, they would actually be maybe going against the law, and there would actually be certain concerns from certain quarters of society who would be saying that there's a security risk, there's a vacancy in the State House, and there's someone who has won the election. So all those the concerns that you're talking about are being addressed in the constitutional making process that is going on here in Zambia. The Electoral Commission of Zambia is not mandated by any law to delay the inauguration of any presidential candidate who has won by a simple majority.
Thank you very much, Richard. Richard Mulonga is a freelance journalist. He joined us live via telephone link from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Nigeria's Middle Belt has long been the site of fighting between Muslims and Christians, as well as between people of different ethnic groups. As the February elections approach, community and religious leaders in the north central state of Kaduna are making plans they hope will keep the streets calm after results are announced. For VOA, Chris Stein reports from the state capital, Kaduna.
The city of Kaduna in Nigeria's Middle Belt is divided by more than just the river that bears the same name. Christians dominate the neighborhoods on the city's south side. The north is filled mostly with Muslims. Local leaders say the two communities usually get along. But after the 2011 presidential elections, rioting broke out in the city and in towns across Kaduna State. Muslims in the city fled Christian neighborhoods. Christians living in the majority Muslim areas did the same. So with Nigerians again heading to the polls on February 14th to choose their next president, again pitting President Goodluck Jonathan against his main opposition challenger, Muhammadu Buhari, community and religious leaders say they are working to prepare people to accept the results of the election and to refrain from a repeat of intercommunal violence. So what brings Christians and Muslims in this religiously mixed city together? In the opinion of Alhaji Kabir Adanlade, it's football. Adanlade has been arranging games between young people from the majority Muslim neighborhood of Tudunwada and Christians in a neighborhood on the other side of the river.
For my own belief is the only way I can unite the youth is through football matches. Because if you can see all over the world, once there is football matches, you see how people unite together. They forget about their differences.
And those differences here are many, not just religious and political. Imam Muhammad Ashafa of Kaduna's Interfaith Mediation Center says conflicts between farmer and herdsmen, along with long-standing economic inequality between the north and south of the city, have played a part in fueling past violence.
There's a long history in the case of the southern Kaduna, a long history of perceived injustices, perceived political domination from the northern part against the southern part of the city.
Alhaji Alatu Alkali is the district head of Tudunwada. He says the root cause of the fighting in 2011 in his area was unemployment. With the district's youth unable to get jobs, many turned to violence to express their disagreement with the election's outcome.
Whatever election, there is supposed to be a winner and a loser. People tend to show their grievances. But the best way to show their grievances is formal. There are courts, there are law places that this thing can be, you know, taken to. But you took it to themselves because, you know, if there is unemployment and the youth don't have anything to do, whatever comes, they are ready or they just want to go about it.
Ashafa is hopeful that this time around, the preparations put in place over the years since 2011 will prevent a repeat of the violence.
We have hope that the 2015 elections won't come easier in Kaduna State and it's tense, but the energy will be managed in a way with the system, if well used, the system we put in place, it will be managed to go non-violently with a higher reduction of backlash.
Ashafa says the center has set up a regional council to monitor for threats of violence and coordinate responses by local, religious, or government leaders to ensure they aren't acted upon. Chris Stein for VOA News, Kaduna.
And a team of lawyers are preparing to legally challenge Uganda government's refusal to approve a retirement request from renegade Army General David Sejusa. David Mushabi, a leading member of the legal team, told me the army used double standards and the discretion of President Yoweri Museveni, the commander-in-chief, to retire favored senior army officers.
It is not 60 days yet, nor is it 90 days yet. But we are ready to keep watching the clock and the calendar. Once it hits 90 days, then we need to ask the government why they are not retiring my client. But we received a letter from the Chief of Defense Forces, CDF, General Katumba Wamala, writing in reply to my letter, which I had written, asking the status of the discharge. And General Wamala, in his letter, he said that it is he was going to wait for the president's response as to whether or not General Sejusa is going to be discharged or when he's going to be discharged. So in a way, he was washing his hands off, saying, look, ask the commander-in-chief. I'm waiting for the advice from the commander-in-chief.
Recently, you had a meeting accompanied by your client, General Sejusa, at the presidential palace where some of these things were discussed. Part of the agreement was that he will be retired from the army so he could go ahead to continue his political activities. Is this the case?
Well, it was not articulated in those particular words. It was the effect that he would be retired and the military was going to handle his retirement process. But it was not in such unequivocal terms per se. It was like, okay, we are going to work on it, we are going to handle it. So there was no unequivocal commitment per se.
But
there was an expression of goodwill that, okay, it's all right, in good faith, we are going to work on it.
But supporters of General Sejusa are saying that they are suspicious that the government might not go through with this, especially when this has happened before and he was turned down with a long legal process. What is your next line of action following these concerns by his supporters?
Our next line of action is legal action in court. That is our next line of action. And probably for me, I can speak with respect to just from the perspective of legal action. But with respect to political activity, that is not my role. That is a decision to be made by him and his supporters. So for us lawyers, we are saying we could take legal action, demanding to apply the same standard like that which has been applied to others who are retired, then the political activists might choose a different course of action.
Some people are saying the military has applied different standards to certain individuals, including the president himself, when they retired from the army, and that these are politically motivated when the process are supposed to be black and white. What is your take on that?
That is true. The retirement process is subject to the discretion of the powers that be. It is not necessary by the book. So it depends on whether or not you are being viewed as a threat or whether or not you are being viewed as a friendly force should you retire. So when you factor into that discretionary powers of the head of the state, then you realize that not everybody can be retired or not everybody would be allowed to retire. So it is subject to the discretionary powers of the commander-in-chief.
Are you prepared for the legal action as you spoke about?
Yes, for us as lawyers, we are over 20 lawyers. We are a team of 20 lawyers. We are ready to take legal action. Should 90 days expire, nothing has been done.
David Mushabi is lawyer for the Ugandan Renegade Army General David Sejusa. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. (Music) A spokesman for the Sierra Leonean government says schools across the country are scheduled to reopen in March following a meeting between President Ernest Bai Koroma and international partners. Schools were closed following the Ebola outbreak. Abdoulaye Bereti says the government has made strides in the fight to contain the disease. He told me earlier that measures the government has undertaken so far in the fight against Ebola is working.
What is making the headlines right now is today the President, Dr. Ernest Bai Koroma, as well as the Minister of Education, Science and Technology, the Minister of Finance and our development partners, including DFID as well as the U.S. Embassy and UNICEF, we have come to a conclusion that schools are going to reopen sometime in March, because let us don't forget, the President made an address to the nation on New Year's Day. He did indicate that he was given instructions to the Minister of Education, Science and Technology to put in modalities in place so that at least we can revive the trend of our young students getting pregnant because they are not in school. And now that the cases are improving, I think we are at a point whereby by March, schools are going to reopen all over the country.
Does that mean that the efforts have been significant enough to reduce the infection rate that necessitates the anticipated opening of schools across the country in March?
Absolutely. And that is one key point that President Koroma underscored as part of his social mobilization across the country. Last weekend, we went to the southern part of the country and the eastern part as well, places like Bo, Moyamba, as well as Kono and Kabala, whereby all the efforts that are on the ground are pointing towards a collective effort on the part of all the stakeholders. But above that, in terms of the reopening of schools, there is a report that indicated that in almost all our districts, the young female students are getting pregnant, and that is really undermining the effort in terms of building the human resource capacity for the future. That is why now that we have the capacity in terms of community care centers, holding centers, as well as treatment centers, majority of which are empty across the country, we have decided that we are going to have sensors and infrared thermometers in all the schools, and also we are going to train the teachers so that they can be part of the Ebola Task Force members in all the schools, because we are mindful of the fact that if a situation arises wherein any student is even just a suspected Ebola case, the entire school system for that particular school will go back. And we don't want that situation. That is why the modalities are going to be put in place. We are going to have thermometers, as well as all the schools across the country that we are used as holding as well as treatment centers. They are all going to be disinfected, because we now have districts. We have districts across the country that have been recording zero cases for the past couple of weeks, which is a very positive indication that if we open schools now, at least we'll be mindful of promoting those measures of avoiding body contact as well.
What is the latest update on the worst hit areas, the Ebola worst hit areas? What's the latest update from there?
Well, the latest here is we have gotten some of our development partners, like in Bombali District, we have deployed as a hospital called the Magenta Hospital. We have the African Union doctors and other clinicians there, managed by Ugandan-led doctor, Dr. Santano. So all of these are putting efforts in place. And the same thing for Post Local District. And in Bo District, wherein we are having problems in a particular chiefdom, the president has implored them that it is better everybody to come on board and work in the interest of the country in a collective effort. Because for us, only one case of Ebola in Sierra Leone is just as dangerous and worrisome as if we just got the first outbreak. That is why whatever measures we are putting in place, we are approaching it from a holistic point of view so that we cannot experience what I will call a relapse.
Abdoulaye Bereti is spokesman for the Sierra Leonean government. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Well, right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today. And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Welcome, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections with the listeners of the Voice of America. Today, I intend to share with them my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. And I always pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. So every week, I pay close attention to the headlines and to developments in the world. And then I try to see to what extent I can focus on a series of issues which are relevant in our understanding of U.S. policy towards Africa. Right now, the events of terrorism in France had serious implications for U.S. policy in Africa because it affects America's relationship with the war against terrorism, which is now so apparent in Nigeria, where a whole state is in a state of collapse because of terrorism. Unfortunately, for U.S. policy, nothing much can be done immediately to resolve the problems in Nigeria, in Mali, or all these other places where terrorism is raging. But America is primarily concerned about how not to allow the terrorists to make any successful story in these United States. And that's one of the reasons why the U.S. government pounced upon some of these terrorists who try to rock the boat in the United States. And the war against terrorism remains a major objective of the U.S. government after 9/11 and even before 9/11. So when we talk about Africa's relations with the United States, the war on terrorism becomes a real problem, a serious problem that must be dealt with frontally, effectively, and majorly. These three adjectives are very relevant in this debate because it has serious consequences, not only in saving human lives, but it is most important in keeping the peace, not only at home, but globally. So that is one of the reasons why when we talk about U.S. foreign policy in the year 2015, the war against terrorism is real, very real. And this is going to be fought vigorously because it involves human lives. And this is one of the reasons why in developing policy, you try to separate emotionalism from reason. And you try to separate ethnicity and religion from scientific and technological development. In the year 2015, much progress is forthcoming in the realm of scientific development, technological development of human beings. Most importantly, the problem of saving human life becomes important because one human life cannot be put in dollar values. But human irresponsibility, human emotionalism could trigger pain, grief, and misery to fellow human beings. So when it comes to foreign policy between the United States and Africa, a number of political issues come to mind. First of all, how can U.S. policy assist the Africans in terms of self-governance? And this is one of the reasons why self-governance becomes primary in terms of African political development. How can U.S. policy assist African political development? The Africans have to be responsible themselves in their own territories. They must govern themselves. America can do with African countries or with any other country for that matter, America has to deal with them as moral partners, moral equals, because they are all united by biology 101. They're all human beings. But the countries are different from each other because of the manner in which they develop their moral, economic, social, and political conditions. So when you talk about American policy towards Africa, you're talking about how America can develop relationships with Africa. There are different dimensions in the relationships. Governing yourself becomes number one. Once upon a time, America was once a colony of England. But over time, the Americans were able to free themselves from colonialism, they became independent republic. Later on in history, there was slavery, which divided America from Africa. Gradually, Americans went to civil war, and black people were freed, and then they became part of the American experience. So one can therefore say, in looking at U.S. policy towards Africa, or African opinions on and attitudes towards Africa, the question of violence, self-governance, becomes very critical this year. And I'll be commenting more on this issue as we move from month to month in the course of 2015. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders in Nigeria say, when a fire starts from the shrine, then no precaution can be possible. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Of the estimated 35.3 million people living with HIV/AIDS, some 3.2 million are children under the age of 15. Most of them, about 91%, live in sub-Saharan Africa. In 9 out of 10 cases, these children were infected during pregnancy, childbirth, or through breastfeeding. At birth, a baby's immune system is not fully developed. In a healthy child, it fully develops by about 6 months, but up to that point, the infant's immunity is boosted by antibodies transferred from the mother through breast milk. When mothers with HIV receive the proper medications, they can safely breastfeed their infants. However, when HIV-infected mothers do not receive anti-HIV medicines, their infants are at risk of becoming infected. Children with HIV infection often get sick. They have a difficult time fighting off common childhood maladies such as ear and sinus infections, pneumonias, urinary tract infections, intestinal illness, skin disease, and meningitis. In developing countries in particular, tuberculosis, diarrhea, and respiratory illnesses are common in HIV-positive children. If an HIV-positive child does not receive antiretroviral treatment, a cycle of illness may set in and further undermine the child's health. 80% of children infected with HIV at birth or in infancy die before their 5th birthday. It is therefore important to begin treating HIV-positive children with antiretroviral drugs as soon as possible. If taken every day, proper medication can drastically reduce the concentration of HIV in the bloodstream, thereby slowing the progression of the disease. But sadly, only 24% of HIV-infected children have access to antiretroviral drugs. That is why the United States, through the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, in partnership with the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, launched the Accelerating Children's HIV/AIDS Treatment, or ACT, initiative. This two-year, $200 million program aims to double the number of children receiving antiretroviral treatment. Through this initiative, some 300,000 additional children living in Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Lesotho, Malawi, Mozambique, Tanzania, Zambia, and Zimbabwe will get a better chance to grow to adulthood and lead full, healthy lives. Healthy children who can pursue their dreams are Africa's future. They will grow economies, create jobs, and contribute to their families and communities for decades to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.